20th century in the United States was Paul Robeson. And he was someone who spoke truth to power in the way Howard Zinn does and Anthony Arnov and all these people in Twilight of Empire and all these ordinary Americans throughout the history of the United States and voices of a people's history of the United States do. Paul Robeson, because when he would go overseas and perform, spoke about U.S. foreign policy and about, you know, the tyrannical aspect of U.S. foreign policy. So the next time he came home, they had his passport taken away. He was not allowed to travel. And he talked about being a member of the U.S. resistance movement in the same sense that, you know, there were some in France who were part of the resistance movement against the Nazis. When he equated the two things, people were scandalized.
But, well, you know, we have to wrap up now, but from Paul Robeson to Viggo Mortensen, we hope we can continue the conversation. Viggo Mortensen is a world-renowned actor, editor of Perceval Press, which just reissued the 2003 book Twilight of Empire, Responses to Occupation. He will be tonight performing in a reading of Voices of People's History of the United States at the atrium at Lincoln Center. And tomorrow night, Friday night at 7, we'll be together at Jackson McNally Books, McNally Jackson Books. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, worldwide at KBOO.FM. Next up is the evening news.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of a dance party benefit for Safer Streets on Saturday, November 7th at 9 p.m. at Crush in Portland. Safer Streets offers free self-defense classes in various easily accessible locations for women in the Portland metro area who are experiencing homelessness, poverty, mental health or addiction issues, for sex workers, and for survivors of violence or abuse. Safer Streets is queer and trans-friendly and welcomes and meets attendees at their particular needs or abilities. That's a dance party with DJ Aurora to benefit Safer Streets, Saturday, November 7th, 9 p.m. at Crush, 1400 Southeast Morrison Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio presents Evil, Cruel Thing Attacking Humanity and Controlled by the Super Rich versus You and Me. This will be an evening on ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. This film and talk will take place on Thursday, November 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater here in Portland. Learn about how this huge, secret political entity, ALEC, creates legislation to keep wages low, to fill prisons, it bankrupts schools, and poisons the air, land, and water. Union reps, teachers, activists, journalists, and others will join moderator and KBOO News Director Jenka Soderberg in a panel discussion on People versus ALEC. Again, that's a film and talk to learn about ALEC on Thursday, November 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland, and more information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Milagro Theater, presenting La Muerta Baila, Milagro's 20th annual Day of the Dead production, playing now through November 8th. Tickets at milagro.org.
And also by the League of Women's Voters of Portland, presenting Coal and Oil Transport, Business Boon, or Public Liability. This civic education program takes place Tuesday, November 10th at 7 p.m. at the Multnomah County Building Boardroom, 501 Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard, more at lwvpdx.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Portland City Council last night voted in favor of a resolution opposing oil-by-train shipments in Portland, while a vote on a second resolution opposing fossil fuel infrastructure in general has been delayed.
An Oregon aviation company has had a suspension lengthened out to 5 years by the Oregon Department of Agriculture because of illegal spraying of pesticides.
And the government of New Zealand this morning released the full text of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. We'll take an in-depth look at what the text contains and what it could mean for the environment and local economies.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, November 5th, 2015. I'm Robert Barncourt.
And I'm Sarika Mehta. The full text of the International Trade Agreement, known as the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, was finally released today. The agreement was posted on the New Zealand government's Foreign Affairs and Trade website. If approved by 12 countries, including the United States, the agreement would establish international standards for copyright enforcement, labor practices, environmental regulations, and more. Because the agreement was negotiated outside of the public eye, critics have claimed that corporations have had too much input and feared the agreement would weaken labor and environmental standards. Many groups have issued harsh criticisms of the agreement, particularly the intellectual property chapter. A number of groups signed a statement today saying the TPP would be a death warrant for the open internet and put free speech in peril. The United States Congress will vote on the proposal by February 3rd. We'll have a full report on what's in the TPP later this hour on KBOO News in Depth at 5:45.
The Portland City Council last night adopted a resolution opposing oil by rail shipments here in the city. The resolution also expresses City Council opposition to Tesoro's proposed oil terminal across the river in Vancouver. This could bring a massive increase in oil trains through the Columbia River Gorge. A wider-scale resolution that would ban the export of fossil fuels from the city of Portland was delayed to a later date. But last night's hearing was filled with testimony of people supporting the City Council's initiative in being a leader in combating climate change.
Thank you, Commissioner, for the time. I appreciate it. My name is Kadra Claybaugh. I am Vice President of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union Local 4 in Vancouver, and I'm here to speak in favor of your resolutions today. We know that the industry touts safety. You know, the shipping industries, the rail industries, they tout safety. That's all they talk about, safety, safety, safety. And I'm here to tell you, as a longshoreman who's worked in the industry for 20-plus years, safety always takes a backseat to production. They tell you what you want to hear, and then they want to move it as fast as they can. Get it on a ship, get it out, get their money. We're tired of seeing our tax dollars go to putting in infrastructure for dying industries. We basically export every natural resource we have. And, you know, what are we left with? Job loss? You know, we don't make anything. As a longshoreman, I export raw material. You know, one of the first jobs I had was putting a lumber mill on a ship in pieces to send to the Philippines. You can go over the Lewis and Clark Bridge and see all the timber we send out. It's time we start investing in America, and I believe this resolution is a good way to do it. So I'm really here on behalf of the longshore workers to ask you guys, please support this resolution. Help us out. Thank you.
Thank you
so much for coming down.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
And some of the supporters stressed a more economic view of the resolutions, and yet they still came down against fossil fuel development.
Good afternoon. My name is Kat Schultz. I'm Vice Chair of the Planning and Sustainability Commission. Personally, I've been conflicted. To combat climate change, we need to think globally. Discontinuing the use of fossil fuels at home and abroad is daunting as it is critical, and we're going to need all the tools in our toolkit. I believe that natural gas and propane can be one of those tools by using it as a bridge fuel. That being said, Portland needs to balance all of the goals that we have set forth in the Portland Plan to create a more prosperous, healthy, equitable, and resilient city. And I'm not convinced that a fossil fuel terminal creates long enough term jobs to justify the risk to our health, safety, and environmental welfare. Therefore, I'm in support of the proposed policies.
That was testimony from yesterday evening's City Council meeting here in Portland. A final vote on the fossil fuel export ban will be held on Thursday, exactly 1 week from today, November 12th.
Last night, as the Portland City Council was voting to oppose oil by rail terminals in the city, the election results from Tuesday's election in Vancouver were being counted, and the opponents of the oil terminal appear to have won a major victory. Eric LeBrant, who opposed the Port of Vancouver's rushed decision to approve a massive oil by rail terminal in Vancouver, appears to have won the race for the Port of Vancouver Commission. His opponent, Lisa Ross, was a major supporter of the Tesoro Savage project. For more, KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Dan Sears of the Columbia River Keeper.
Could you talk about the Port of Vancouver commissioner election and what's going on with it and what the impact might be on a potential oil terminal there in the city of Vancouver?
Yeah, to be blunt, it's been a bad 24 hours for Tesoro Savage and their proposed oil terminal in Vancouver. To start with, Vancouver voters, by a large margin, elected Eric LeBrant, who's a candidate who opposed the massive oil-by-rail facility that's been planned in Vancouver, Washington. He was running for Port Commission at the Port of Vancouver, and he beat an opponent who was supported by Tesoro Savage and who supported the oil terminal. So it was a very clear referendum on the oil-by-rail issue as a whole in Vancouver, and he won by a large margin. So it was a very clear statement by the people of Vancouver and Clark County that they don't support the Tesoro Savage oil terminal. What this does in the future is, you know, it puts a person on the Port Commission who at least is going to have a more critical view of how the Tesoro Savage oil terminal would play out in Vancouver. So as they've done for years at this point, the residents of Vancouver and their allies across the river will be going to the Port Commission and urging them to get out of the lease for the Tesoro Savage oil terminal and really putting pressure on the Port Commission to reconsider the mistake they made by agreeing to that project back in July of 2013. The second good piece of news is that the city of Portland weighed in with a very strong resolution also opposing the Tesoro Savage oil terminal in Vancouver. And so they actually are now standing in solidarity with the city of Vancouver, which is opposed to the project. And so for the Port of Vancouver and for Tesoro Savage, looking in all directions, the Northwest is rising up and making very clear its opposition to these massive, climate-polluting, highly dangerous oil-by-rail facilities.
Well, and let's talk a little bit about the Tesoro Savage facility. I understand that if it does move forward, it will be the largest in the Pacific Northwest, the largest oil terminal?
That's right. It would be the largest oil terminal in the United States for oil by rail. At 360,000 barrels of oil a day of potential capacity, the Tesoro Savage project in Vancouver would be 42% of the Keystone XL pipeline. So if someone were to, say, propose a pipeline down the Columbia River that was half the size of Keystone XL, you'd say that was crazy, and they would be sort of laughed out of town. But that's essentially what Tesoro Savage is doing, except they propose an even riskier form of oil transport, moving oil by rail. Not that pipelines are safe. They're demonstrably unsafe, and we've seen terrible spills from pipelines. But these oil by rail facilities are drawing trains through communities that are derailing, spilling oil, and igniting with catastrophic consequences.
Now, with this City of Portland resolution that passed yesterday, if Vancouver decides to go ahead with the Tesoro Savage oil facility, will the trains have to move on the Washington side, or will they be able to travel across the Oregon side of the Columbia as well?
Yeah, the sort of shorthand answer to that is oil will flow to money. And if those trains find a faster path on the Oregon side, there's nothing to stop them from coming down the Union Pacific tracks and then crossing across Hayden Island, going north into Vancouver. In fact, we're very concerned that the oil trains will make a loop, that they could come down one side of the river with the empty trains returning on the other. The good news is that people are standing up, and the likelihood of the Tesoro Savage project moving forward grows more and more dim with cities like Portland and Vancouver and voters turning out to state their opposition emphatically and in large numbers.
And what is the current status of this Tesoro Savage oil terminal that is being proposed in Vancouver?
We expect the draft environmental impact statement for the project to be issued on November 24th of this year. That will trigger public hearings, likely one in Vancouver, sometime between late November and early 2016. And so that's a point where we can take stock of how the state of Washington is reviewing the project. We can see whether they're drawing the appropriate conclusion, which is that the project would have significant unmitigable impacts on the city of Vancouver and all the communities along the proposed rail route, as well as the climate. And we'll see how the state of Washington addresses those issues, and it'll be a very important time in November, December, and January for people to weigh in and pressure the decision makers in the state of Washington to do the right thing. The Portland City Council's action empowers the city to speak with a full throat and to speak loudly on the issue now when that EIS is issued. So it was a very important step in that regard as well.
And even developers, as I understand it, are opposed to this, to Soros Savage Oil Terminal. There was one in Vancouver who has proposed a waterfront development with shops and housing on the Vancouver waterfront, but would not move forward with that if this terminal is built. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, the Graymore Development Group is sort of in the lead of this waterfront development that Vancouver has been planning for many years. It's over a $1.2 billion development that's supposed to connect Vancouver to its waterfront and help with the overall revitalization of Vancouver's downtown. Now, that project is directly at odds with this huge proposed oil terminal, which would be the largest in the United States. And so it's created a very unusual and broad coalition where we have the Longshore Union speaking out vocally against the oil by rail facility. The Firefighters Union is now speaking loudly in opposition to this oil by rail facility. The Graymore Development Group, the largest developer in Vancouver at this point, is also speaking out against it. So it's no longer a debate about jobs versus the environment or jobs versus climate. It's very much a debate about what Vancouver's economic future is going to look like. And so it's a jobs versus jobs argument. And, you know, so Graymore is surrounded by labor and small and medium-sized businesses who've banded together in the Vancouver 101, a group of businesses who are speaking up against the project. It's an unusually broad and robust coalition, and I think that was reflected in the election result this week with the election of Eric LeBrant.
Well, thanks so much. Again, I've been speaking with Dan Sears with Columbia Riverkeeper about this week's election of Eric LeBrant in the Port of Vancouver Commission election. And LeBrant is a major opponent of the proposed Tesoro Savage oil terminal in Vancouver there. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
On Tuesday, citizens of Gladstone, Oregon, approved a ballot measure that allows the city to sell parcels of land, among other fundraising activities, to pay for a new city hall and a police station. Together, the new buildings will cost over $11 million, and the city estimates that it can raise $3 million of that through the sale of some city land. As KBOO reported last Thursday, many citizens have become concerned that the city is poised to sell the Gladstone Nature Park, which is a 10-acre plot between Oatfield and Webster Roads. It's currently undeveloped except for a foot trail funded by the regional government, Metro. It's listed as a park on Gladstone's website, but its zoning is actually commercial development. KBOO reporter Sam Bowman spoke with Nancy Eichstadt, a resident of Gladstone who lives near the park, about the controversy surrounding the land and what citizens are doing to prevent the sale.
Nancy, can you refresh my memory again? What is the likelihood, as citizens understand it, that this park will be sold to fund police station and city hall?
The ballot measure listed certain city properties to help to fund the two projects, the city hall and police station, and one being worth $3 million, and the only city property worth that amount, everyone knew, was the Gladstone Nature Park. So it's highly likely it will be sold, or some sort of monetary agreement will happen.
What's next for citizens who don't want this park to be developed?
Well, what's next is to try to find some way to work with the city so that we can preserve the 10 acres. There's trees up there. There's a lot of wildlife. We have bald eagles. We have all kinds of things on that piece of property. The only development that's happened was from a loan through Metro to build a nature park from Oatfield Road to Webster Road that lots and lots of people use to walk their dogs or to walk up to the junior high. So we need to find a way to preserve the property so that it doesn't become what it ultimately could, which was the last time it was on for sale, it was going to be a gravel pit. They were going to mine all the acreage, cut it down to street level, and then ultimately build a strip mall in the middle of a residential area where it's not really needed. The mining was going to take at least 3 years, and it would involve blasting and dump trucks, hundreds of thousands of dump trucks on our roads that are not built to support that kind of thing. So that was what we faced the last time, and this means that we'll be facing that again because that's where the money lies, is in the gravel on the property.
There were plans at one point to build a library on that site, and
that's correct.
And what happened to that?
There was a movement in town to block any kind of building that was more than $1 million without a vote of the people, and a group that called themselves Save Gladstone did a lot of campaigning to convince people that the library was going to raise their taxes, which was not true. So they managed to get that measure to fail. Then they turned around and came up with this Portland Avenue development concept. They want all new development that's civic to be down on Portland Avenue, which I don't know if anybody's been through there lately. There's not a whole lot of space. There's a city hall and a police station, but they're really crowded. So the property was going to alleviate, you know, that situation. So we would have liked to have seen a library built on the property, but it's probably not going to happen at this point in time.
I had heard that the new station, the police station, has been proposed for sort of a central site in Gladstone that currently houses a number of existing businesses. Is that true as far as you know?
I haven't heard about that. They've been looking up and down Portland Avenue for the last year to try to find space for both of those. The police station and the city hall are on Portland Avenue. The library, current library as it stands, is not on Portland Avenue, but it's nearby. Most of what's down there is a mix of residential and small businesses. So if you decide you want to locate something down there, you have to purchase or condemn property, and it's a very small area. So that means taking out businesses and homes that people already are living in.
Is there anything planned around this, the developments going on surrounding the park in the upcoming days?
Well, we had one last weekend. We'll probably be doing some more. We set up a GoFundMe site called Gladstone Nature Park Preservation, and we're hoping to raise some money to help drive some sort of campaign about preserving the natural area of the site.
All right. Nancy Eichstadt, thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Thank you.
For KBOO Evening News, this is Sam Bowman speaking with Nancy Eichstadt, a resident of Gladstone, Oregon.
An Oregon aviation company responsible for illegally spraying employees and residents has had its license suspended for 5 years. This is an extension of a 1-year suspension that was already imposed by the Oregon Department of Agriculture. In addition, the department has increased the fines against Appleby Aviation from $40,000 to $180,000 in total fines. Daryl Ivey, a former employee who blew the whistle on Appleby Aviation's dangerous practices, spoke with KBOO's Connie Kasnowski about the latest in the case.
For 6 months now, I've gone behind agencies trying to get people to do their jobs and what their titles are, and then to have such a huge fine be levied against the company is very validating to the claims that people that have gone before me, and then obviously my claims and my videos. But it definitely is a shocker that these agencies came down with such a big hammer. I did not expect that. I don't think anyone expected that.
Well, is this something, this is not the first time they've been fined?
Appleby Aviation's been in and out of the public light quite a while in a negative way. I talked to the FAA 5 months ago. As a helicopter mechanic, I've spent a couple $100,000 getting a license that allows me to work on helicopters and aircraft. And I told the FAA that these airships were not airworthy. And Monday, when he crashed in Sheridan, I called and I talked to the FAA to see what they had done and what their investigation had turned up. And they said that they couldn't talk to me about it. And then you know, I asked him, I said, well, what would have happened if that aircraft had been full of chemicals and landed in Grandma's living room with, or in a daycare center, instead of a field out there collecting Christmas trees? Does that mean, you know, so what has to happen before you guys actually take action? And then today I see the department drop, you know, a five-year suspension on them and $160,000 plus all the other fines that the other agencies have levied. So it's a big eye-opener. It's a jaw-dropper. But it's also disappointing that our state agencies are doing their job, and now the EPA and the FAA still have yet to come up with any fines, charges, or penalties against this company that is in the public light in a negative way on a, seems to be, a regular basis. One thing that I think's gone unnoticed and unsaid in this whole situation, not just with Applebee, but with aerial spraying, is the timber companies that hire these aviation companies also have herbicide and pesticide applicator licenses, and no one's even brought forth the spotlight in their direction as to why you would hire such a rogue company with such a bad track record. And then when your own employees have herbicide, pesticide, aerial application training, why would they allow such practices to take place on their land? So I think there's a whole other can of worms that this is leading to in the next couple of months.
With this five-year license suspension with Applebee's Aviation, specifically the owner, Michael, will he perhaps lease out his fleet and continue doing what he's doing but under an alias?
Well, that's a really, really good question. When I worked for Evergreen Aviation in McMinnville, I was a helicopter salesperson. And I didn't sell the helicopter itself. What I did is I went around and I solicited contracts for the helicopters. And there is a whole lot of different ways that that can be gone around, yes. One of the ways that we did it is we'd go find other helicopter companies that were small businesses, and we would put our name on them. And that way we could compete a small business. And so there's, he can lease his fleet out. There's probably three or four different options that are still available to him. He could also get someone else with another license and maybe work under their license, but they would have to be willing to assume a whole lot of risk due to his reputation and you know, the prior instances that he's had. Trying to find insurance for his helicopters, trying to find, he's going to have a really rough go from this point forward. Whether or not he leases the fleet out or whether he leases someone else's license to work under, it's now, I think that the state agencies have really made a strong point to where it's going to be very difficult for Mike Applebee to work and to go forward unless he's got some sort of really, really sneaky ace in the hole up his sleeve. I don't see how it's going to be too easy on him from here forward. The FAA is going to have to at one point come forth. And the EPA will at one time have to come forth. I mean, these are federal agencies that we give these people white hats, we give them badges, we give them guns, and we call them good guys. Mm-hmm. And we expect them to go out and to, I mean, that's their job. And, mm-hmm. and they wear the white hats. They're supposed to go out there and keep us safe, or at least keep our environment safe, or whatever their job or their title is. So at one point, they're going to have to come forth also. So I agree with you. This is not over with, and I still have to say before you go that I think the spotlight needs to turn on to the timber companies that hire these rogue companies that just do whatever, because the timber companies are just as knowledgeable on how, who, what, when, and where to spray these chemicals, because their own forest reps are licensed themselves. So everything that goes wrong, that Applebee does wrong, or any other aerial applicator contractor is doing wrong, these people that are representatives of the timber companies also are fully aware of it because they've been through the same training, if not probably more extensive training. So are they turning a blind eye for the money? There's a whole lot of questions still to be answered, not just with the FAA and the EPA coming down with their fines, but there's a whole lot of questions that have to come along with the stewards of the forest, these timber companies that say that they're taking care of our lush green forest here in Oregon. Yeah, there's a whole lot of dark corners there that I think if you shine a flashlight that people are going to be surprised.
That was Daryl Ivey, a whistleblower and former employee of Applebee Aviation. The company's license was initially suspended for a year, and that license suspension has now been extended to 5 years.
Last night, the Portland Human Rights Commission confirmed its resolution calling for the City of Portland to divest from companies directly involved in Israel's military occupation of Palestinian territory. This followed a long 3.5-hour hearing that was filled with passionate public testimony.
2 weeks ago, the commissioners voted unanimously to support a resolution calling for divestment from four companies who have contracted with the Israeli military. At last night's hearing, the commissioners heard from opponents of the resolution who argued that divestment from these companies was unwarranted. But the Human Rights Commission held firm in their endorsement of Occupation-Free Portland's letter to the city's Socially Responsible Investments Committee. The letter calls on the city to put Caterpillar, G4S, Hewlett-Packard, and Motorola Solutions on the city's Do Not Buy list. These companies supply weapons and machinery to the Israeli military, which has been documented engaging in human rights violations using this equipment.
Portland city officials have ordered increased protections on the city's oldest trees. On Wednesday, a proposal was made by City Commissioner Amanda Fritz to increase the costs on developers who cut down large trees. In response to the proposal, four members of the Tree Code Oversight Advisory Committee resigned in protest. The four members are connected to the construction industry and say they felt their input was not valued. Under the new proposal, which has not yet been passed, instead of a flat fee, developers would be required to pay on an inch-for-inch basis when removing a tree of at least 48 inches in diameter.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with Melinda St. Louis of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch about the recent release of the full text of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. This will be followed by Rose City Native Radio at 6 o'clock. At 7, it'll be Ear to the Streets of Portland with news about organizing in the African-American community here in Portland and the surrounding area. Tomorrow's weather will be partly cloudy with a high of about 59 degrees, that's pretty near 60, and a low of only 44. Rain, however, is unlikely. Today in history, in 1831, Nat Turner was tried, convicted, and sentenced to death in Jerusalem, Virginia. Turner had led a slave revolt that resulted in the death of 60 whites on various plantations and as many as 257 blacks during the retaliations that followed the event. Most of those were lynched by local mobs and had little to do with the uprising. And in 1916, five members and supporters of the Industrial Workers of the World were killed in Everett, Washington, along with two members of the Snohomish County Sheriff's Department in what became known as the Everett Massacre. The quote for today is from Helen Keller. She said, "Our democracy is but a name. It means that we choose between two real, although not avowed, autocrats. We choose between Tweedledum and Tweedledee."
It's just about 5:32, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
"Too many people are behind bars that don't belong there," declared a group demanding major reforms to America's throw-them-all-in-jail mass imprisonment policies. For nearly 50 years, politicians and prosecutors have pushed a no-mercy, tough-on-crime mantra, which has proven to be grossly unjust, exorbitantly expensive, counterproductive, and needlessly destructive to families and whole communities. "We need less incarceration, not more," the reform group recently proclaimed. Of course, you'd expect the ACLU to urge a humane and just approach to crime and punishment. Only, this is not the ACLU. Called Law Enforcement Leaders to Reduce Crime and Incarceration, it's made up of 130 of our country's top crime fighters, including big city police chiefs, sheriffs, and prosecutors from coast to coast. These are officials who've built careers on the harsh autocratic practice of police sweeps and mass arrests, especially targeting impoverished communities of color. They know the difference between actually reducing crime and posturing as crime busters by hoking up charges and hustling thousands of people into prisons for minor offenses. When such a broad group steps forward to say they were wrong, that the rush to prison makes crime worse, that's a possible sea change in policing philosophy. Indeed, they're calling for, one, more alternatives to imprisonment, especially for addicts and the mentally ill; two, reclassifying many nonviolent crimes as misdemeanors and reforming ridiculous mandatory sentencing laws. And 3, a wholesale effort to repair the dangerous rift and loss of trust between police and the communities they're intended to serve. This is Jim Hightower saying, as one of the group's leaders put it, this is just common sense. To get involved, go to BrennanCenter.org. BrennanCenter.org. Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out at HightowerLowdown.org.
President Obama's hopes to close the military prison at Guantanamo Bay were set back today. The House voted 370 to 58 to approve a defense spending bill that would restrict the president's efforts to close the prison and move the 112 remaining detainees to other countries or into the United States. Closing the prison was a priority of President Obama's 2008 presidential campaign, and now it will be harder for the president to get the funding needed to move the prisoners out of the controversial facility in Cuba.
Chelsea Manning has written a bill that would abolish the secret surveillance court that currently exists in the U.S. Manning is currently serving a 35-year sentence for releasing classified government documents that revealed the extent of U.S. violations of international law in Iraq and Afghanistan. The 129-page bill was written by the imprisoned soldier in the prison library. The bill would abolish the so-called FISA court created by the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Instead, Manning says, requests by the government to engage in surveillance should go through the regular court system. According to Manning, despite the passage of the USA Freedom Act last June, the secret surveillance courts remain largely in place. Manning says that her experience researching and writing the bill while in prison was her most, quote, most difficult undertaking yet. After a shakedown in July, she had begun the project again from scratch. She completed the full bill in about 3 weeks and now hopes to submit it to Congress for consideration. No member of Congress has yet stepped up to sponsor the bill. But the digital rights group Fight for the Future has launched a petition calling on lawmakers to consider the policy changes outlined in Manning's bill.
And the New York State Attorney General has issued a subpoena to the ExxonMobil Corporation to try to find out exactly what Exxon knew and when the oil giant knew it. Inside Climate News, one of two outlets whose investigative reporting spurred this inquiry, said that the subpoena seeks documents from Exxon related to its research into the causes and the effects of climate change. It also demands any documents on the integration of climate change findings into business decisions. Communications with the board of directors and marketing and advertising materials on climate change are also included. The subpoena comes amidst increased scrutiny into the company, following revelations that ExxonMobil knew decades ago that its actions were devastating the planet. But instead of following recommendations from its own scientists, the company instead funneled money into groups that sought to undermine climate science. Following the reporting by Inside Climate News and the Los Angeles Times, presidential candidates, elected officials, climate leaders, and advocacy groups have all called for investigations into Exxon's corporate behavior. Climate activist Bill McKibben said today that New York's attorney general has shown great courage in bringing to court what is arguably the richest and most powerful company on earth.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Skilled trades workers at VW's Chattanooga plant had their NLRB hearing on a requested election for union representation this week. VW put out a statement that said it believes that the skilled trades maintenance worker unit election is not consistent with the company's one-team policy at Volkswagen Chattanooga. But Mike Cantrell, president of UAW Local 42 at the plant, says he sees no reason why these workers can't have their election to get a collective bargaining agreement and at the same time have the ongoing meetings with VW management continue for the production workers.
We have
good communication. We still, as far as I understand, we're still going to continue with COE policy, community organization engagement policy. As president of Local 42, I represent skilled trades and production as well, and so we still have an ongoing meetings with the company. We have meetings every 2 weeks with HR and once a month with the CEO and some other people, and express some concerns and ideals that we have and suggestions, and we still feel like we will have that. Hopefully we'll still have that process continue.
VW is calling for a full vote by all production and maintenance plant employees in Chattanooga. National Nurses United is welcoming the news that TransCanada is suspending its U.S. application to approve the Keystone XL pipeline. The Nurses Union opposes the pipeline as a significant threat to public health. Building trades unions support the pipeline, citing the jobs they believe it will create. The nurses say pollutants in the tar sands oil the pipeline would carry and the mining process to produce it have been linked to cancer, leukemia, genetic damage, and birth defects. SEIU Florida is pushing to raise the state's minimum wage to $15 an hour. On November 10th, the Florida Fight for 15 is organizing rallies across the state, from Miami to Fort Myers, Gainesville to Tampa, as well as Fort Lauderdale, Sarasota, West Palm Beach, Tallahassee, and other cities. SEIU says 52% of Florida workers make less than $15 an hour. State lawmakers have been challenged to try living on the Florida minimum wage of $8.05 an hour for just 5 days. So far, 17 legislators accepted the challenge.
Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from union-owned and represented Bank of Labor, member FDIC, equal opportunity lender. Bank of Labor offers a business Visa card with no annual fee and points earned with every purchase, as well as rental vehicle and travel accident insurance. More info online at bankoflabor.com.
Let's get America working. We must build, maintain, and repair our nation's crumbling infrastructure. Teamsters support a bipartisan approach to creating good jobs for American workers. Learn more at letsgetamericaworking.com. Teamsters strong, America stronger.
You've been listening to WIND, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
In the wake of huge protests in the Romanian capital of Bucharest, Prime Minister Victor Ponta resigned yesterday morning. The protests erupted on Tuesday night when an estimated 20,000 people took to the capital's University Square. The catalyst for their anger was a fast-moving nightclub fire last Friday, which killed 32 people. The fire was started by Stage Pyrotechnics, and while the owners have been arrested, the protesters placed the blame squarely on official corruption and failure to enforce regulations. The protests appear to have grown beyond these concerns, however. Yesterday night, after Ponta's resignation, the number of people in University Square rose to 35,000, and similar protests were organized in other cities, some of them attracting thousands of people. President Klaus Iohannis announced today that his current education minister would be Ponta's replacement, despite Iohannis' statement and apparent willingness to engage productively with the protesters. The crowd in University Square remains defiant, and their numbers are growing. The mayor of the Bucharest district, where the nightclub was located, also resigned on Wednesday, but protesters could be heard that night shouting in unison, quote, "You cannot buy us with two resignations."
Yesterday, the Maldives instituted a state of emergency in the aftermath of an alleged assassination attempt on President Abdullah Yameen. It strips all basic rights and institutes martial law on the island nation of less than 400,000 people located in the Indian Ocean southwest of Sri Lanka. Today, the parliament also approved the impeachment of Vice President Ahmed Adib, who was arrested as a suspect in the assassination attempt. Adib's arrest was based on a recently passed terrorism law that uses tough restrictions to combat potential support for the Islamic State among the population, which is legally required to profess Islamic faith in the 2008 Constitution. Both the U.S. State Department and the United Kingdom's representative in the region have formally denounced the emergency declaration and the arrest of Adib. They have also called for the release of former President Mohamed Nasheed, who was jailed earlier this year on terrorism charges in a trial that many international observers worried was politically motivated. Nasheed was the Maldives' first democratically elected president after the transition to democracy in 2008, which followed 30 years of autocratic rule. He was a champion for taking action on climate change, as the island nation is set to suffer some of the more immediate and devastating effects of climate change.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast. We encourage your participation. You can call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Connie Kostanowski and Robin Ryan. The producer is Sam Bowman. Special thanks to Chris Andre. Our excellent engineer is Matthew Olson, and the KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jinkus Olderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers. So if you have a pen or something to write with, the local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Oregon Governor Kate Brown's number is 503-378-3111. And Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Robert Barncord.
And I'm Sarika Mehta. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Positively Revolting Talk Radio, guest host Lisa Loving speaks with Mary Newmare, who gained national attention last month when she broke up a demonstration against Planned Parenthood with a homemade sign thanking the Women's Health Organization for helping her control her yeast infections. At 9, on Political Perspectives, host Jean Bradley speaks with renowned historian Ray Raphael about his latest book, The Spirit of 74, How the American Revolution Began. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, on Intersections Radio, hosted by me, Sarika Mehta, we feature Celeste Ng, author of Everything I Never Told You, and Sarah Novich, author of Girl at War, and A Story from Deaf South Asian America. And at 11:30, we hear from Ashley Haight, Ruth Oliver, and Sarah Merck of the 9th Annual Siren Nation Festival of Women's Visual Arts, Spoken Arts, and Music. Thanks, KBOO members, for your crucial support for KBOO Community Radio. If you're not